All right, so this morning, let's begin with a question. I think this is an okay question to ask. So can you think of a time that you had to carry something heavy for a long period of time? So maybe like a baby or a backpack. So what did that feel like? So think of a time you had to carry something that was kind of heavy, and then just share with a neighbor, how did that feel? All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. Go ahead. So you want to throw out some of these words? What were we feeling when we were carrying something that was heavy? Anybody? Someone over here? I think I heard. Tired? Sore? Uh-huh. Strain? Good. Excited to be done. Good, I like that. So a few months ago, I was speaking in Seattle. And then after the conference, I got to go bike camping in the San Juan Islands. And so here's a picture of us. Some of our friends came up from Austin. And so we were carrying this heavy load. Our bikes probably weighed like 60 pounds. And so we took a train to Anacortes. The bikes met us there. And here we are unloading our bicycles. And then we rode to the ferry, ferry camp repeat. It was magical. And so you can go to the next slide. So there's us loading the ferry. And that's us riding, camping. Go to the next slide. So our last day was going to be our long day. And it was 100 miles home, 5,000 feet of climbing. And those numbers in itself aren't terrible, except we were carrying 60 pounds worth of weight. So I remember I woke up the next morning, and my legs were already kind of exhausted from carrying this load for a few days. And islands, it turns out the islands are super hilly. I guess it's just like the peak of a mountain sticking up out of the water. So you wake up and then you're immediately climbing. And I was like, oh man, my legs aren't feeling great. I just remember thinking, I've got 100 miles of this still to go. Got on our first ferry. We got off. And then one of my friends was with us, Spencer. He actually comes to Vox. He was having knee problems. And I didn't know that on the ferry ride, he arranged somehow to get a car. And then he was going to drive home. And the moment we all heard that, we all thought the exact same thing. Oh, we're going to drop off all of our gear. So we, you know, rode his car, and then everyone, you could see everyone smiling as they're like lightening their bikes. And it was like this whole huge burden was lifted. So maybe a question we can ask this morning is what are the burdens that we're carrying? Maybe for some of us, it's a season of transition. It's like a lot of unknowns, so there's a burden. Maybe some of us were in the middle of something relational. Maybe there's conflict, or maybe you feel bad about something you did, and you're kind of carrying that around. Maybe some of us, it's a season of doubt in our faith. Our faith that used to work just doesn't work anymore. And in our lectionary text this morning, Jesus says, "Come to me, all of you who are exhausted, because you're carrying these heavy burdens." And then he promises a lighter way to live. Like, what do we think of that? Like, do we believe that's actually possible? Like, there's a way to live where we don't actually have to carry the weight of what we're carrying. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says it like this: "Only the man who follows the command of Jesus single-mindedly and unresistantly lets his yoke rest upon him, finds his burden easy, and under its gentle pressure, receives the power to persevere in the right way." He's writing this from a concentration camp, by the way. The command of Jesus is hard, unutterably hard, for those who try to resist it. But for those who willingly submit, the yoke is easy and the burden is light. And so what I wanted to do this morning is maybe explore some practices and possibilities. What if there was actually a lighter way to live? What if there are some practices that we could learn together? And so this morning we'll be in the lectionary text, Matthew chapter 11. We'll have verses 28 to 30 on the screens. So as is our custom, turn to a neighbor, read it, and then we'll walk through it. All right, let's pick this up in verse 28. It says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and carrying these heavy burdens." Like, the thing that makes it just a little harder to wake up in the morning, or day to day, just putting another foot in front of those, like those burdens. He says, if you're exhausted, come to me. He says, I'll give you rest. Then it says, take my yoke upon you. So I was in the Congo a couple years ago, and we visited a nonprofit that was working to train cattle to do agriculture. In that part of the Congo, they hadn't used cattle before. They would just plant things randomly. The problem was that the cows in that region were small, and most manufactured yokes, I have a couple pictures here, were just too heavy. And so they had to redesign the yoke so that they could actually carry this yoke. And what Jesus is saying is the yoke that we're carrying, it's too heavy. We're not meant to carry that. He's like, take my yoke. It's easier. It's lighter. And then he says this, learn from me. Like you can learn this. Like there's a practice. If you practice this, there's a lighter way to live. And then what does he say? For I am gentle. So the question is, how might gentleness allow us to live a life that's lighter? So let's try a thought experiment, right? Okay, so let's try this. So think of two descriptives, adjectives. Okay. Don't think too hard about it. Just like stream of consciousness, the first two descriptors that come to mind. Okay, you ready? First two adjectives that come to mind when you think of God. All right, two words. Maybe powerful, controlling, creator, love, mercy. Okay, you got those two words? Okay. Now think of a recent time you made a mistake. It's like a small one. Maybe you lost your keys. Maybe you forgot an appointment. Now, when you make a mistake, what's the first phrase that enters your head? My go-to, I've got a couple ones, good ones, like, what's wrong with me? That's like my main, what's wrong with me? Or what's wrong with my brain? Right? Those are like my first two. And I wonder if our descriptors of God inform how we describe ourselves when we make a mistake. And I wonder if anyone, when I said, think of two descriptors of God, I wonder if any of us said gentle. And what would it be like for us to receive God's gentleness this week? So I've been in Detroit for a couple weeks. I got ordained. So, okay, I just want to... Thank you. So I want to just say it's unusual. A couple things that are unusual. That I got ordained and none of you really know. That's unusual. I'm going to explain it, okay? And then... it's unusual that I got ordained, and it took me 20 years. Most people, it takes 3 to 5 years. So I've been resisting this thing for 20 years, and I've had all these wonderful reasons. I'm not into institutions. I don't need titles, right? I had all these things. But we're a part of a denomination, and they graciously just nudged me towards ordination. They're like, it's okay. You can do it. So it's a 2-year process. I wrote a 20-page paper. I defended it. And then 2 weeks ago, I went to Detroit, where I first started pastoring. Like I moved to Detroit 20 years to the weekend that I got ordained in Detroit. Pretty awesome. Okay. So I was up there. We had a rehearsal the night before the ordination. And at the rehearsal, I was like a toddler or like a teenager. I just couldn't sit still. And in my mind, I was like, I don't need this. I had all these reasons. And then afterwards, Waylon was also there. He was there for the meetings. There was an annual meeting there. And then we're having dinner. And so I'm doing my little dance. I'm like, I don't know, like not an institution. I think I had talked about aesthetics for a while. I was like, maybe I don't like that. I was reaching. And then so Waylon knows me pretty well. And some of you have heard part of my story over the years. But I grew up in a really repressive childhood. So several reasons. I grew up in fundamentalism. So my faith was mainly things I couldn't do. I couldn't watch movies, couldn't play cards, couldn't go to the arcade, couldn't drink, couldn't smoke, like all those things. So it's just very repressive. And then my parents are immigrants, and it makes a lot of sense. Immigrants land in a country, everything's foreign. Everything feels scary, so they're trying to protect their kids, and they hold them at home. And then my parents both come from kind of abandonment narratives. And it's normal when you come from that, you usually overcompensate. And so my whole life was just like, right? Just couldn't do anything. And so you come back to Detroit, Waylon and I are having dinner, and I'm like, I don't need this. Da, da, da. And then Waylon pauses. He goes, do you think this title, like this is a title that represents all of that repression? And I was like, oh my God. That's it. My first response, I was actually a little embarrassed. And I felt a little shame. My first thing in my head was, what's wrong with me? And then my therapist, I'm seeing a Jungian analyst, and he says, just put your arm around the younger Gideon. So I was like, all right, I'm going to try it. So I'm picturing me as a teenager not being able to be myself. And I was like, I'll just put my arm around younger Gideon. And when I did that, I actually sensed a palpable gentleness of God in that moment. Like, I was so embarrassed. There was like this, but God's gentleness was like, look how far you've come. Like, look how much I've healed you. Like, it's a miracle that you're even pursuing faith. It's a miracle that you're part of a faith community. And he's like, look at the community. Like, I get to be a part of this community. I get to contribute to it. And in that moment, this thing I didn't want to do through God's gentleness became so healing. And it gave meaning in a new way that was unexpected to the ordination. And so for us, what would it look like in our lives to receive God's gentleness? You know, I was thinking through this. Remember the story when the religious leaders used a woman as a pawn for their theological turf wars? And so they're trying to trap Jesus. They somehow find out this couple's having an affair. So they hunt them down. The dude gets to walk, of course. And then they drag her to publicly shame her. It's not about her. They're just trying to trap Jesus. And then Jesus refuses to participate. He just starts drawing in the sand. He's just like, and they're like, what's going on here? And then Jesus goes, you know what? We should totally stone her. Like, this is the thing we should do. So here's a rock. Whoever hasn't made a mistake or hasn't sinned, you throw it first. And then one by one, they walk. And then Jesus asks her, has anyone condemned you? She's like, no. And he goes, neither do I. What he's saying to her is, you're not worthy of condemnation. You're worthy of love. And then he says, now go and sin no more. And theologians for decades have been like, well, she didn't even apologize, right? He didn't give her three steps to like transform. And what they don't realize is condemnation doesn't transform anyone. But in gentleness, when you mirror to someone they're worthy of love, that changes a person. So I thought maybe a spiritual practice here could be this. I was thinking through, like, so why is God gentle with us? Like, why? So think of the most valuable thing you own. Maybe it's a vintage instrument. Maybe it's a piece of art. Maybe it's a sculpture. Maybe it's a baby. For me, this is my grandfather's watch. He used to collect watches. When he passed, I got one of them. And I take it off almost every day when I ride my bike. And I've never thrown it. I've never dropped it. Like, every day I place it down gently because it has value. And you think of God, who says time and time again, you're fearfully and wonderfully made. How much more than these objects? So the next time we make a mistake, just think of how you treat that object of value, the gentleness, the delicacy that you treat it with. And imagine that's how God treats us. So it says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle. And then he says this, not only am I gentle, I am what? Humble in heart. So the essence, it's like not something I'm doing. The essence of who I am is humble. So I'm going to try defining it. So I'm going to take two steps here. So stay with me. All right. So let's say in scripture in Philippians 2, Paul defines humility like this, right? He says, in humility, consider others better than yourself, right? I think we have it on the screen there. So let's take that as like a starting point in terms of a definition for humility. So maybe for our purposes today, we could rephrase that and we could say humility is when others being better no longer has power over us. That we can say, oh, that person has a better job, better life, better house, better living situation. They're a bit better artists. They're a better athlete. And we can say those, and there's no power. We can just go. So maybe we could rephrase that. And for our definition of humility today, what if humility is our inherent worthiness freeing us from the need to be better than others? I think that'd be a lighter way to live, right? We play all these games. Do you remember there was a show called Running Wild? Is anyone? Okay, I think no one watched it except for me and my wife. So right after Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz and Will Arnett created this show. And we were like, oh, it might be like Arrested Development. No one watched it. I think they canceled it halfway through the first season. But Karen and I watched it, and we enjoyed it. So this is actually part of, it's from the pilot.
Permission to enter, my friend.
That's Steve's neighbor, Fa'ad.
Permission granted, Fa'ad.
They're always one-upping each other.
He's flaunting his new horse. Get my new horse! The big one! Check it! He's coming, he's coming!
My horse.
Get me mounted. Get him!
Ah, salam. Look who's back from Dubai. And I brought back the pride of Yemen.
In your carry-on?
No. Any man who could afford a stud smaller than my peanut surely has made a deal with the devil.
Are you saying they get more expensive as
they... As they get smaller, yes, yes. But yours is a monstrous beauty.
Well, I couldn't be prouder. I actually like being up high. Like I will be on the stage when I receive my Humanitarian of the Year award. They tell me that it's a remarkably small plaque.
I favor a bigger plaque, but what sort of friend would I be if I did not trot over and RSVP personally? I shan't be coming!
And yeah, I like this picture, because we have all these reasons for our versions of this, why ours makes total sense. And I love, like, it just keeps going. And the absurdity of, like, you can only get a bigger horse until it stops, and you got to get a smaller horse. We did the same thing with cell phones. Remember, we got smaller and smaller, and then now it's bigger and bigger, right? So you guys following? So what if humility, then, it frees us from the need to be better than others? You guys following? Okay. Let's take this one step further. So Anthony DeMello, I think Jason quoted him a couple weeks ago. He's a Jesuit rabbi, a priest in India, and he wrote this book, The Way to Love. It's one of the most profound books I've read. It's like a small little pocket book. And he has this one chapter, he called it Discipleship. And he says, we don't question our programming. He says, we're programmed to think if we just had better blank, then he calls it happy, then we'll be happy. But I think he's saying the same thing. Then we'll have lighter lives. And so he says this. I think we have it on the screen. He says, we think if we just get better things, right, we'll have lighter lives or we'll be happy. He says this. There's not a single moment in your life when you don't have everything you need to be happy. The reason why you are unhappy, because you're focusing on what you don't have rather than what you have right now. He says, or some of us, we're programmed to think, if I just had a better future, if my future just changes, then I'll have a lighter life or I'll be happy. He says this, right here and now you are happy and you don't know it because your false beliefs and your distorted perceptions have got you caught up in fears, anxieties, attachment, conflict, guilt, and a host of games you are programmed to play. He says, or we think, if I just had a better situation, like a better environment, if like the things around me would just change. And he says this, you stupidly squander so much energy trying to rearrange the world. If changing the world is your vocation in life, go right ahead and change it. But do not harbor the illusion that this is going to make you happy. Do you realize you could change every one of these things and still be unhappy, still carry these burdens? Deep down, you know this is true, but you waste your effort and energy trying to get what you know cannot make you happy. Or he says, lastly, we think we just get a better fulfillment of desires or our attachments. He says, these very desires and attachments make you tense, frustrated, nervous, insecure, fearful. The fulfillment of desire can, at the most, bring flashes of pleasure and excitement. Like we get these adrenaline hits. We go, oh, that's it. But he says, don't mistake that for happiness or living a lighter life. And so I want to add to our definition. So if you put up the first definition, go to the next slide. I think DeMello would add this, and I think it's profound. What if humility is our inherent worthiness, freeing us from the need to be better than others and freeing us from the need for our lives to be better than it is now? I don't even know if I believe that, but I think you would ultimately be free. Like, I think that's lightness. That's ultimate freedom. That's why when James and John, they're like, hey, so Jesus, because they're thinking of the future. They're playing the long game. They're like, so one day when you are glory, One of us will sit at the right and the left, right to the right, to the right, to the left. And then Jesus, I imagine with utter gentleness, going, no, like that's, you're going to be enslaved to the same thing. Those chairs will never be enough. And then he says, if you want to be first, be last. If you want to be last, be first. I think what he's saying, if you're okay being last, the power of being first has no power over you. You'll ultimately be free. And he says, learn from me. Learn from my gentleness. I'm humble in heart. And then he says this, and you will find, what does it say? Rest for your soul. I like that it's passive, because we live in a world that says, do more, try harder, be a better person, better human, better husband, better teacher, better student, better coworker, better leader, like better, better. And it's exhausting. And Jesus is like, just stop. Like, rest into your worthiness. Like, relax into your soul. And I was thinking about this. I realize that I don't know what it feels like to rest in my soul. Like I like the idea of it. And I wonder, because I think our whole lives, we're chasing, there's like this dis-ease and discontent in our soul. So we're chasing all of these things to try to ease whatever's happening. And I propose that some of our mechanisms for trying to feed our soul is the very thing exhausting our soul. So I'll give you an example. So my father recently told my sister how he taught me how to swim. So I don't harbor any resentment to my father. I think this was like the main methodology of that generation. There were probably books like this is how you should teach your kid how to swim. But he asked my sister, hey, you want me to tell you how I taught your brother how to swim? She was like, sure. She's like, he was 4. Told him to jump in the water. And he was like, no, I'm scared. So I asked your brother, hey, do you want a Coke? And your brother was like, yeah. So he went to get a Coke and then I pushed him in. And he was like super proud of himself. And I've always known this. But I actually think my need to perform, I have a performance thing. My need to perform feels like life or death. In my whole life, I've been chasing this thing, trying to ease my soul. But the very thing I'm trying to ease my soul with is exhausting my soul. And so I'll just finish with this. I'm going to offer a spiritual practice that we can do together right now. And then I'll post it on the website if you want to revisit it. So in DeMel's book, he has a series of questions that helps us feel our soul. What does rest for our soul feel like? So I'm going to ask you a series of questions, right? So if you can, just in your seat, take a deep breath. You can close your eyes. You find your center. You can breathe in. Then exhale. So I invite you to recall the kind of feeling you have when someone praises you, when you are approved, accepted, and applauded. Like, what does that feel like? Then he says, now contrast that with the feeling that arises within you when you look at the sunset or the sunrise or the beauty of nature. He says they feel different, don't they? He calls the first feeling a worldly feeling. By that he means they're not natural. He's like those feelings we were taught by society and culture to make us more productive and more controllable. He says these feelings do not nourish your soul. So that second feeling is when your soul is at rest. Now recall the kind of feeling you have when you succeed, when you've made it, when you get to the top, or you win a game or an argument. What does that feel like? Now contrast that with the feeling you get when you really enjoy the work you're doing, the creative process you're absorbed in. It says, notice the qualitative difference between the first and then when your soul is being nourished. says, remember that feeling you had when you had power, when you were the boss. People looked up to you. They took orders from you, or you were popular. You were highly sought after. He says, contrast that with the feeling of intimacy and companionship. The times you thoroughly enjoyed yourself in the company of a friend or with a group where there was fun and laughter. Then he says, what would it look like to arrange our lives not to exhaust our soul, but to rest, allow our souls to rest? And so you can open your eyes now. And I wonder if this is what Jesus meant when he says, what do you benefit if you gain the whole world, if you've impressed the whole world, you've achieved the whole world, you've earned the whole world, but you lose your soul? And so this is my prayer for us this morning, Vox. There is nothing else to do now but rest and patiently learn to receive the self. The self that you've forsaken for the race of days. At first, your thinking will darken and sadness will take over like listless weather. The flow of unwept tears will frighten you. You have traveled too fast over false ground, and now your soul has come to take you back. Take refuge in your senses. Open up to all the small miracles you rushed through. Watch the way of the rain when it falls, slow and free. Imitate the habit of twilight. Take time to open the well of color that fostered the brightness of day. Draw alongside the silence of stone until its calmness can claim you. Vox, may we be excessively gentle with ourselves. May we steer clear of those vexed in spirit so we can linger around someone of ease who feels like they have all the time in the world. And by God's grace, may we return to ourselves, having learned a new respect for our hearts and the joy that dwells far within slow and ordinary time. And we pray this in the mercy of the Father, the grace of the Son, and the gentleness of the Holy Spirit. Amen.